A city is a living entity. Being alive, it grows and changes. Delhi, India's capital, has had 7 different locations in its long history, until the British in the 18th century established New Delhi for their administrative purposes. Now, Cleveland, of course, is a much newer town, but has also had its growth cycles. Cleveland was founded in 1785 by the Connecticut Land Company, who sent out a party of surveyors under the leadership of Moses Cleveland to chart the area and to determine a capital for it. The Northwest Territories, the area that they surveyed, have been sold to some Connecticut entrepreneurs who, like all real estate dealers, want to cash in on their investments. This Northwest Territory extends along Lake Erie's shores from the New York border to about Fremont near Toledo, and then for some 50 miles south of the lake shore, the whole length of the territory. Cleveland was not the surveyor's first choice as the capital of the new area. The basin of the Cuyahoga River was swampy and disease-ridden, malaria. The surveyors contented themselves with mapping out a future town and moving on. There were to be few permanent residents in Cleveland for some decades. Cleveland did not become the major city of this area until the 1840s. Cleveland's development was due to its geography and to the vision of one man. It was a port city, or at least had the potential of becoming one. Sandbars blocked the entrance to the Cuyahoga River until they were cut out in the 1820s. In the first 35 years of Cleveland's existence, settlers did what most of their descendants would do 150 years later. They fled to the suburbs, or rather to a series of small towns which surrounded Cleveland. They left to live outside the malarial zone, but they remained in the area because they recognized that Cleveland was its natural center. Cleveland growth was determined almost entirely by a single decision. The decision whether the northern terminus of the Ohio River Canal would be located here or not. Among the few settlers in early Cleveland, there was a certain Alfred Kelly. He had read law, engaged in many businesses, and he became dedicated to the proposition that Cleveland should be the terminal point of the proposed Ohio River Lake Erie Canal. As first mayor of Cleveland, as a substantial citizen, as head of the Commercial Bank of Lake Erie, Kelly is an intriguing figure. Kelly is really the reason that Cleveland exists on the scale that it does today. As a member of the state legislature, he worked hard to get the Ohio River Canal legislation passed. Even then, he envisaged that Cleveland would be its northern terminal, and that decision proved to be the key to Cleveland's future. Cleveland became the great market town of the region. When the Ohio River Canal became fully operational in the late 1830s, it quickly established itself as the cheapest and surest way of transporting goods to the eastern and southern markets. Agricultural goods were brought in from Michigan or Indiana for transport east. In exchange for these agricultural products, manufactured goods came west. Important decisions leave a trail. As a terminus of the Ohio River Canal, Cleveland found the will and the federal monies to drain the malarial swamp and to rid the harbor of the sandbars that made it difficult for ships to approach the shore. Kelly's vision was vindicated. It had been no foregone conclusion that the canal would have its northern terminus in Cleveland. It could have ended at the Grand River Basin or at the Chagrin River Basin or at any other of a number of places along the shore. But it went to the mouth of the Cuyahoga River because of Kelly's vision and his determination. Once the canal was open, Cleveland's growth was electric. In 1830, there were fewer than 1,000 residents in Cleveland. By 1850, the year the temple was organized, Cleveland was already the 18th largest city in the United States. There was massive change in Cleveland business and commerce life in the 1850s and the 1860s, when ships became large enough to bring sizable cargoes of iron ore down from the Mesabi Range. Barges brought coal up the canal from southern Ohio and western Pennsylvania, and lime was brought in from Indiana. Cleveland was steel's marrying point. Steel undergirded almost all of the Industrial Revolution in the United States, and Cleveland became one of the great steel centers, one of the great industrial centers of this country. Cleveland entered a period of steady growth, fueled equally by the riches of the Mesabi Range, by the industry of its citizens, and by the immigrant population which came here beginning in the 1880s to man the factories. Cleveland was booming. The boom no longer depended upon the canal. Its heyday had been brief. By the 1850s, its monopoly over commerce had been broken by the railroads. Railroads went to far more places than the canal did. So Cleveland became a great railroad center. Here was the largest railroad repair yards in the United States. Here the rails themselves were built. At a halfway point between New York and Chicago, Cleveland was an ideal place for the repair and rebuilding of the sinews of the railroad system. In the 7 decades between 1850 and 1920, Cleveland exploded in population. These were the years in which Cleveland rushed to fame. There's a population of 300,000 or so in Cleveland in the 1850s. By the late 1900s, Greater Cleveland had become a metropolis of 2 million souls, the fifth largest city area in the United States. The iron and steel industries brought heavy industry with them of all kinds, machine tools, manufacturing equipment, and other ancillary industries such as dry goods and paper. Cleveland also became in these years a great ethnic center, particularly in the decades around the turn of the century. It became the 100,000 town, 100,000 Italians, 100,000 Poles, 100,000 Germans, 100,000 Hungarians, even 100,000 Jews. The workforce came from two sources: domestic immigration from the South and Eastern United States of whites and blacks, and Europeans who came right off the boat and settled in Cleveland because they had heard of the city's opportunities, because they already had relatives here. Cleveland became a prosperous town and a smug one. The business leadership felt that they knew the secrets of eternal prosperity: make the best goods possible and sell them at the lowest possible price, if need be, by taking advantage of your workers in order to cut the price. Cleveland was a town of low wages, a town where skilled labor was useful, was often let go as mass production systems made less skilled workers equally useful. 40% of Cleveland's workers were skilled in the 1880s. By 1900, only 19% were. This disdain for labor had its effect. It turned Cleveland into one of labor's strongholds. Depression and the Second World War obstructed for a time how Cleveland was sliding from its top rank, obscured for a time how Cleveland was sliding from its top rank. Shortly after World War II, a New York Times writer marveled, and I quote, "that Cleveland display an inordinate, exuberant enthusiasm for their town and their way of life, such as you don't recall ever noting in any other city east of the Alleghenies. It really is remarkable, their town boosting, their local pride and contentment." That contentment, however, began slowly to obscure a number of other developments. That our manufactured items were no longer competitive in world markets. Industry had not invested in research and development during the glory years, was not therefore prepared for the technological and scientific change of the post-industrial era. By the 1960s, Cleveland's slide from fame could no longer be obscured or denied. Cleveland had lost half of the manufacturing jobs and its sense of itself. Instead of becoming the best location in the nation, it had become the mistake on the lake, the butt of innumerable national jokes, a city without a personality, a city with little pride in itself, where even the river caught fire, where not only the river, but the mayor's hair caught fire. Recent years have seen our population remain constant or shrink, while population has been increasing in much of the rest of the country. Unemployment here runs higher than the national average. For the first 20 or 25 years after the end of the Second World War, there was no concerted effort to develop new business. Less money was spent by Cleveland industry on research and development than by industry in most other urban areas. Local banks were content to lend money to U.S. Steel and to Jones and Laughlin, and were not willing to back the bright ideas and the brimming energy of young business people whose ideas and hopes required lesser sums, whose ideas and hopes could have built the sinews of a new city. The end result was a kind of stagnation that affected our economy and our politics. In 1978, Cleveland became the first city to default on its bank loans since the Depression of the 1930s. Race riots were spawned by the appalling conditions in which Cleveland's leadership had allowed its working class to survive. The Hough riots here were second only to the Watts riots in Los Angeles in their intensity and in their duration. And our problems didn't end with the end of the riots. After the riots, we saw a once proud school system racked by internal racially bred dissension, unable to educate its young. A school system which drove one of its superintendents, and there were any number of them, to suicide. These were years of rapid demographic change. Hough, which had in 1950 a population that was 48% white, had by 1960 a population that was 95% black. What happened in the city of Cleveland began to happen outside its borders. East Cleveland had fewer than 3% blacks in 1960, and by 1970, nearly 60%, and a school enrollment of 92%. During the mid-1970s, there was no major construction in the town, in the city of Cleveland, and a great deal of demolition in the fringes of the town as neighborhoods fell before the ravages of rot and time. During all of the posh post-World War II years, there was a continuous exodus from Cleveland. Some of those who left were among the best and the brightest. Many were not. But they all felt that there was a better life to be found elsewhere, a life with a better climate at least. And it was time to move away from the noise, the garbage, and the crime, and maybe most importantly, to cities where the leadership was more in tune with life in the post-industrial era. For a while, it seemed everything was going wrong. The problems Cleveland faced boggled the imagination. It was a great manufacturing city that lost a quarter of a million jobs in one decade. A national survey discovered that we were second only to Newark in urban blight and urban crime. Then when things seemed to be going from bad to worse, some 8 or 9 years ago, there seems to have been a turnaround, at least in mood. New commitments were made to building downtown, for which the Standard Oil building stands as a proud example. There seemed to be more young people who remained in town. The flats, Public Square, Playhouse Square, the University Circle saw rapid development. The Art Museum and the Symphony maintained their world-class standards. Institutional growth was apparent. The Cleveland Clinic, NASA, university hospitals, and the beginning were seen of the retooling of some of our factories. Yet our manufacturing industries were still spending only half the national average for research and development, and they're only spending that amount today. Our employment remains static while it was rising elsewhere. Racism remained an issue. Still today, a racially split school board cannot elect a president without the courts having to intervene. Housing remains an issue. Cleveland has a rotting housing core surrounded by suburbs which have most of the amenities that one could desire. The city of Cleveland has lost over 400,000 people in the last two decades. It's during the most recent decade that things seem to be improving. The federal government continued to pour money into Cleveland. A new highway system was finally completed. Some public housing was built. Various UDAG and other programs were completed. Welfare programs were maintained. But Cleveland hasn't used the monies coming in as wisely as it might, because the people of the area are still unwilling to organize themselves into a single governing unit. There are 88 governing entities in Cuyahoga County and nearly 30 educational districts. Authorities overlap, and the reach of any government unit is small, so small that none can carry out wide-ranging programs. This balkanization is particularly severe at the county level, where 23 special agencies, numerous elected officials, and the county commissioners spend more than $1 billion a year. But no one unit of government has any direct influence over how these funds are located or allocated. These regional agencies have developed in part because the city, through its population loss, and its eroding tax base, and its abatement programs, has been forced to sell or to make over to the county any number of its once proud and owned services. And so today we have a regional transit commission, a regional sewer authority, a regional water authority, and the like. In each instance, the city made a one-time sale, took its money, and was left with no power. And the control of these agencies and services passed to the county commissioners, who did not give account or report to any legislature. Case in point of how this regional and unaccountable system does not work was the recent revelation that after a multi-million dollar renovation of the rapid transit to the airport, it now takes 10 minutes longer to get there than it did before the renovation was begun. County government has been on the agenda for 60 years. It is no closer today than it was 60 years ago. Clevelanders seem to have an aversion to centralized government. In the 1830s, there was a move to annex Ohio City on the west bank of the Cuyahoga River to Cleveland on the east bank. A bridge was built. But the Ohio City folks would have none of it. They tried to stop the bridge from being built. And when they couldn't do it by political means, they tried to saw down the bridge by physical means. In 1924, the first of the modern attempts at county government, the annexation of Lakewood and West Park to the city of Cleveland, went down to defeat. And so is every attempt at county government which has been submitted to the voters since. Why this negative attitude? In the first place, no one likes to give up office, and no group likes to give up its prerogatives. Then, too, our housing patterns reflect ethnic and racial divisions which play themselves out in the political arena. In the past, it was Croatians against Slavs. Today, it's largely blacks against whites. Will this be a white-ruled or a black-ruled community? That's the way the question is really put. Today, the City Council of Cleveland represents only about 1 in 5 of the citizens of the county. Among that fifth are numbered the poorest and the most handicapped. The city of Cleveland lacks a tax base to meet the obligations of the center city, to prevent crime, to keep the streets clean, to get the garbage picked up, and so on. Its political divisions have compounded problems of racial unrest. Traditional American patterns expect the center city to educate the immigrant, black and Hispanic, today, so the suburban schools are clear of that responsibility to concentrate on teaching middle-class youngsters. But a school system is also a source of patronage. As an example, The contract to feed the students of the city of Cleveland is lucrative. And so the issue really is, which community, the white or the black, will get that order? Major part of the problems of Cleveland have resulted from changes over which Cleveland has had no control. These are the basic economic changes which have affected the whole nation. Steel is no longer an American monopoly, but is manufactured around the world. The countries of the Asian Rim can replace the methods of our big factories and effectively compete in world markets. While some business leaders still tend to blame unions and high wages for our problems and fail to recognize that they smugly believe that government owed them a living, fortunately, a new breed of leaders seems to be emerging in both management and labor. Men and women who have been trained for an era of change, the era of our post-industrial age. Over the last decade, such men and women have set about to do something about the city and about Greater Cleveland. They have created businesses designed to invest capital in new enterprise. They have created scholarship programs to help poor students go to college. There are many problems that still cry out for attention. Cleveland's neighborhoods require continuing attention. The demographies of the people who live in the city of Cleveland suggest that the city continues to be increasingly poor, elderly, and dependent on public monies. The housing stock in the city of Cleveland is old, with very little replacement underway. Neighborhood commerce is limited and dispersed. Industrial areas are poorly situated and lack many modern amenities. The outlook for the city itself remains in many ways distressing. Whether Cleveland continues on the new path depends on the vision and determination of each of its citizens. The city is really simply its people. And there may never again be enough of us to make Cleveland the fifth largest city in the country. There are enough of us to make it a livable, healthy, and vital place. That requires each of us to think of ourselves as citizens, not just as residents, and to invest some of our time, some of our talent, and a great deal of thought in our town. Amen.